Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, I'm Alex Zane, and welcome to Just the Facts, a conversation about the career and achievements of a different actor or filmmaker every week. And welcome to episode 25. If episodes were years, we're a quarter of a century old, but they're not, and we're not. But we are blessed with a wonderful guest this week for episode 25, an actor who is as at home in comedy as he is in drama. The brilliant Jimmy Akingbola is my guest on the show, all the way from his home in Los Angeles, where he is currently shooting Bel Air, a dramatic retelling of the globally successful sitcom The Fresh Prince of Bel Air, exec produced by Will Smith himself. So I'll admit to being a little surprised when I found out Jimmy actually lived in LA, simply because he has been such a familiar face on some huge British shows, from Tom Hollander's Rev to ITV's massively successful sitcom Kate and Koji, which came out last year, to the crime drama The Tower, which aired last week on ITV on three consecutive nights and is now available to watch in its entirety on the ITV Hub. We talk all about those shows, about his love of straddling both drama and comedy, how it all began for him, and what made him decide to make LA his home. We also talk about DC's Arrowverse, auditioning to be part of that show, and what it's like playing a superpowered bad guy. That's all coming up in 30 seconds time. Very quickly, a little request from us here at JTF Pod. As always, if you do like the show, please subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. And if you've got time to leave us a quick rating and review, that would be lovely. Really appreciated. Also, give us a little follow on Instagram and Twitter, if only so you can play each week's edition of Guess the Guest. Congratulations to Gary Bailey and Arden on Twitter, and Aaron Seddon and Bobby on Instagram, who were our first four correct answers in this week. A well done, gentlemen. Finally, if you would like to watch this interview as opposed to just listen, the full video interview will be available on our JTF Pod YouTube channel this Friday. Subscribe now. Enjoy. All right, then. It's time. Please welcome to Just the Facts the tremendously talented Jimmy Akingbola. Right, time to kick the tires and light the fires.
Let's do it.
Jimmy, how are you?
I'm good, Alex. You know, I'm in LA, so the sun's out. I don't want to gloat, but I'm getting messages from friends saying, Jimmy, it's horrible. It's cold, it's dark in the UK. So, yeah, to start off talking about the weather, I'm really good. I'm happy. I'm a happy man.
You can take the Brit out of Britain, but it's still a weather-based conversation. I won't lie. It's freezing here, Jimmy. It's winter feels like it's arriving now. So it's a good time to be in LA. Do you like it out there? Are you having fun out there?
I am, Alex. I love it. I remember the first time I came out here. I think I did a short trip in 2010, and immediately I just connected with the spirit of the place. Do you know what I mean? In terms of, I suppose, yes, the weather, but also the energy, the possibility, the sense of things can really happen here. And I've always had a few sort of Brit friends out here doing their thing as well. So that's always been very inspiring. But I'm a sun baby. I know I'm bringing it back to the weather. But I'm a sun baby, Alex. Seriously, I think I've got a little bit of SAD. You know, it's that thing when you wake up and it's dark. You go and do work, you know, and you come out on your lunch break and it's still dark. You're like, but it's 1 p.m. Oh yeah, you missed that 30 minutes of sun at 11:30, Alex. You know what I mean?
That's interesting that you talk about the energy of the place. Like when you say that, does it feel different for you in that industry specifically, I guess, working out there compared to the UK?
Yeah, it does. I think it really does. I think there's a sense of like positivity here. You have to have it because it's so hard and crazy here, and there is the yin and yang of this place. You know, there is lots of opportunity and it's really exciting. But on the other end of it, you know people can fall off here. It can be really, there's a lot of sort of a broken dreams, I suppose, and I think the pressure can get to people, as well as I think mentally I think it can be challenging here, that you're surrounded by, I don't know, sort of success in all different forms. How big's the house? Who's on that billboard? You know,
everybody's
looking great. So there's lots of things, depending on what type of person you are, you have to work through. But yeah, the UK I do love also, but it's just, there's a sense of, I call it grind, that's required, I think, with the UK. And even like in London, I think in some ways I needed a change. You know, I needed a city that was a bit more vast, open, you know, better weather, and had a different sort of attitude about it. And everyone's like, why did you not go to New York? And I was like, well, New York reminds me of London. Sometimes New York is like London, but the UK times 200, you know? And I was just like, oh, I don't need that. I want to keep the work ethic, but I want a different sort of environment around me. And here I am.
Yeah, there you are. And what you're doing out there is pretty gosh darn exciting as well, what you're filming out there. I'll let you tell me what you're filming out there at the moment, rather than I've read all about it because I'm fascinated by it as a concept. But what is it?
Yeah, I'm filming a series called Bel-Air. For those of you that are listening, it's a remake of The Fresh Prince of Bel-Air, but it's a drama. So we're not having the audacity to try and do the comedy again. I don't think you can. The comedy still stands up now. But this is a reimagining of the comedy, hour-long drama. EP is Will Smith, Quincy Jones, all the original people from the original show. And I'm playing Jeffrey. I'm playing a man like Jeffrey. And I'm so happy about it because it's an iconic show that we've all grown up with. It's a show you can... You say this name anywhere in the world, Alex, and people are like, oh yeah, I know that show. And it's exciting to do a retelling of it. So we're all able to own these iconic characters that we know and we've grown up with. And because we're able to sort of go deeper with an hour, you're able to flesh out all the themes a bit more. And also in terms of Jeffrey, we're going to be able to get to know more about him, because the setup in the comedy, he had some really good sort of one-liners, but you didn't really know much about him. He had a couple of episodes when he, you know, he thought he had won the lottery and he told them what he thought of them. But in terms of this dramatic version, I think you're going to get to know all our favorite characters even more.
Because it's a comedy drama, isn't it? It's certainly not a sitcom, I know that, but it's still, there are jokes in it. It's not just a pure dramatic retelling, or is it?
No, it's a pure dramatic retelling.
It's
a pure dramatic retelling, Alex. Yeah, my analogy, Alex, is like, I'm a big fan of Only Fools and Horses, right?
Yeah.
So if you take the comedy out of that, you've still got working class boys, you know, from Southeast London trying to do well, you know what I mean? And, you know, trying to sell stuff. And, you know, if you take the comedy out, there's still a lot of hardcore themes. They're missing their mother, you know, having to look after the granddad. You if you just sort of, I call it flip it a bit, you could do an Only Fools and Horses a drama. And I suppose there are going to be light moments in the show, but yeah, it's a full on dramatic verge. And I suppose the song, right? He has a fight in the on the basketball court, and then he gets sent to Philadelphia, and you know, that's all light. But if you have a fight with someone that literally might be someone on the streets that might have a gun, like, you really have to get to Bel Air because you're fearing for your life. And I think just not to give too much away, if you start from that point, it changes everything. And also we're in a different time now, right? Alex, you know, in terms of social media, where we are politically, but also, was it 20, 30 years on, a lot still hasn't changed, you know, in terms of, you know, racial profiling and stuff like that. So I think it's going to be a really exciting show. And I think we're going to be able to please those people that know the original, but also those people that are coming to it for the first time.
And it's a kind of fairy tale story, isn't it? How this came to be in the first place. So there's a guy, Morgan Cooper, who puts it, I think it's a trailer or a short film, a kind of an idea splurge, let's call it, a video that he puts up on YouTube of this concept. And then it catches the attention of Will Smith.
Yeah, I know. Listen, you know, the space that you work, you know what it's like to have people watching your content and, you know, for it to be shared and, you know, you build up your following. But for this director to, one, Alex, I think it would spend like 20 to 30 grand to do this trailer. There was no guarantee anyone would see it. You know what I mean? We've all put things on YouTube and it's like, oh, I've got 20 followers. Oh, that's my mum, my cousin, that's my mate, you know? And to put this out there, it was amazing because when I saw it towards the end of 2019 and it looked so good, Alex, that I thought it was the trailer for the actual show. I was a bit peed off, really. I was like, oh, shot it already. not worth even contacting my agent, like they've cast it already. And then when I heard that, basically I believe in doers and he's a doer, he did this trailer almost as a calling card as a director, because he's done short films, he's done a lot of commercials and stuff like that, but actually for him it was a win-win. You know, I'm showing, like, I'm expressing myself as an artist, and I believe in it. I think it's great. If anything happens, great. If not, then this is something I can use to go and speak to production companies or networks. And then I think it was in 10 hours, Alex. Within 10 hours, I think it went viral. And I think Will Smith called him probably after 5 hours, the rumor is. And that might not be true, but I know, like, somehow he's got the call and it's like, who's this? He's like, hey, it's Will. And then the rest is history. He's very talented.
I think you hit the nail on the head, though, because from everything I've heard about it, it's uncynical in the way he went about it. It wasn't that thing, because I think you could look at it on paper and go, oh, man, I wish I'd had that really clever idea to get the attention of Will Smith to pitch an idea on YouTube. But I think, like you say, he made it because he wanted to show off what he could do. And sure, he had this idea, but it was without cynicism.
Yeah, no, you're so right. You're right. And you know, come on, sometimes you can't play those games with yourself. You're like, oh, I'm going to do this. I don't really want anything to, but when you really are in that place of like, look, this is just what I'm doing, you know, then I think great things happen. And within this job, there's so many beautiful connections. And, you know, even me playing Jeffrey, you know, when people find out I'm in the show, they're like, oh, who are you playing? I'm like, really? But I get it. There's a lot of Brits playing Americans. But for me, it's such an honor to play Jeffrey. Joseph Marcel, who played the original, you know, I've worked with him before.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. So even that little connection to say, like, look, we've worked together and now I'm playing this iconic role that you created. And it's, you know, mine's going to be a bit different, but I'm really proud of that. And it's so nice to see people's faces when they're like, oh, my God, you're playing Jeffrey. And I just feel like it's an exciting time to be a part of a show that the way it started, it reminds me of Ryan Coogler, who created Creed, right?
Mm-hmm.
He was a young man that used to watch Rocky with his grandma, you know, and Rocky's an amazing movie. But he went and repitched it to Sylvester Stallone, kept chasing him down, going, look, this is the new Rocky. Stallone was like, what? Well, obviously, like, that was like the Great White Hope story, great. But if you look at history of heavyweights, we haven't got a Rocky with a black boxer yet. And it's just crazy, you know? And then I think it took a while, but then Sylvester's like, of course. And now we've got this whole new retelling of Rocky, but it's called Creed. And it's still connected. You've still got the original characters. And I think that's when I get excited about sort of things being redone. You know, it's the way in. When there's a blatant, like, oh, we're just going to do Dirty Rotten Scoundrels again. I'm like, oh, that's a classic. You can't really touch. You shouldn't really touch that. Just create something else.
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. This sort of the description of how Ryan Coogler sort of, you know, let's say he chased Sylvester Stallone down and did keep pitching it, and that tenacity. But also, that kind of fits into what you're saying about being in LA and sort of being on the doorstep of those people and that environment and being able to do that. Do you feel like that you have that opportunity yourself in terms of being so geographically close and part of the machinery of LA now and Hollywood and making this show that you are in the right place at the right time to make stuff happen for yourself?
I do, Alex. I mean, I moved out here in sort of 2015, and I've been going back and forth because it's always been important to me to keep working in the UK. But
I think that would come as a surprise to people because obviously you're so prolific on UK TV, you know, with Kate and Koji, with them, the Idris Elba show on Sky One. In the long run. So I think I didn't realize you'd been out there that long.
Yeah, I had. And I suppose it came from off the back of what you were saying. When I left Holby City, it was bizarre. I was only in the show for 3 years and it wasn't my first TV break. You know, I had done like shows like Rev and, you know, Holby Blue and lots of theater. But I felt a bit of a glass ceiling, you know, in terms of UK is much smaller and there's a sense of like one in, one out. Do you know what I mean? If you've got a type, you know, well, we've already got you, the one of you, we're not going to give you anything. And I was like, actually, the US has always been something I've been interested in. And also, I think the way that I operate my energy, I'm an actor, but I like to produce my company, Triforce Creative Network. We've always been doing sort of stuff around diversity and inclusion before it became buzzwords and a big thing. And I think coming to America, give the pun. Love that movie. Oh, wow. That was perfect. I want to be coming to America 3. But coming to America, I just felt like I could do everything I'd been doing in the UK, but on a higher level, because you are on the doorsteps of people that can make it happen. I jumped in an Uber and I bumped into like one of these top commissioners of like Amazon. And she was a Brit and we just hit it off. And she's like, well, what did you do? I was like, well, I'm doing this show at the moment, blah, blah, blah. I was on Arrow at the time. But I was like, oh, I've got this production company and we do a lot of stuff with diverse writers and actors. And next minute, oh, here, let's exchange emails. And, you know, all right, my company's talking to Amazon now. And again, like the way the guy put the trailer, Morgan Cooper put it out, I wasn't like, who's in this Uber, sharing this Uber with me? I wasn't just being cheap doing an Uber pool. But it's like, oh, yeah, Let's talk. If you're a Brit, I'm a Brit, let's talk. And then actually, if you're already doing something, Alex, then when those situations happen, it's not so Machiavellian, right? You can just be like, oh, great, you're in that space, I work in this space. And if something happens, if there's a connection, great. If not, there isn't. And I think that's in the producer side of things. But as an actor, in my first year, I was like bumping into, I don't know, Demi Moore's going up for J-Lo, sort of show, Matthew McConaughey movies. And it was just like, this is a bit different from, no disrespect, from, you know, doing my first episode on Doctors.
It is mad, isn't it, LA? I mean, I remember the first time I ever went there. I was put up in the Mondrian by the film company on Sunset. And I was like,
look at that.
Whoa, yep. This is cool. Yep. Went down for breakfast. Spike Lee having breakfast two tables away, having a meeting over breakfast. I'm like, this is insane. That like,
crazy.
I'm, just, I'm just at a hotel and there's fucking Spike Lee over there. It's amazing. Yeah, it's yeah. LA, man. It's crazy,
right? How do you feel when that happens? Like, it's a weird one, right? Because, you know, you might bump into Jonathan Ross in Soho and stuff like that, and that's all cool. But someone like Spike Lee, like, it's just...
But it's that double-edged sword, though. It's like you said at the start. On the one hand, you're like, this is amazing because, you know, he's right there. And I would love to be involved in that conversation. I want to be the one sitting opposite Spike Lee pitching a freaking movie to him or something. Yeah. And then you're not. And so you do then sort of go, oh, shit. Like, unless you're in that world, then you are just always an observer watching people having those meetings.
There you go. And there's the yin and yang of it. You're right. There's the yin and yang of it. And if you do try and go and talk to him, you get kicked out.
Yeah. That's the harsh reality. We can all go, I could just go over and tell him about my movie. You couldn't. No, you couldn't go over. So I saw the video where Will Smith lets Jabari Banks know that he's got the part of Will. It's on YouTube where he gives him a call, tells him he's playing Will in Bel Air. Mm. Lovely video. And it's like obviously pretty special for him because I think it's one of his first big gigs.
Yeah.
One of his first major gigs, full stop. How did you find out about it though? Did Will call you?
Obviously, Will was too busy to call me. That's it. We're not talking. I'm not doing this anymore. Speak to my age. You know what he did? No.
No, I'm joking. Obviously, for Jabari, it is, you know, it was a very special moment to give the kid a break in a movie. But, you know, you're a seasoned pro. You don't need to hear from Will, man.
Yeah, exactly. I was like, it's cool, you know? But no, he didn't call me. But when I got the call, Alex, it was quite interesting. I'd been in the UK for almost 2 years. I went back to do In the Long Run with Idris Elba. And then I was ready to get back to LA to get back on the LA momentum. And then something happened, this thing called the pandemic happened. And so I realized that I had to be in the UK and be around family. It was a really tough time. And then when this, I had a year of like being close to some amazing big jobs, like, you know, the Apple series, some great films, Netflix, Amazons. And it's like, you know, I'm very grateful. I work quite a lot, but everyone's like, Jimmy, you must get yeses all the time. I'm like, no, I still get a lot of no's. Do you know what I mean? A lot of close calls. And so when this came, the audition came through, it said Jeffrey, and I think it said in the 50s. And I was like, you know, I like character actors. Like, you know, I feel like I do leading roles, but, you know, doing stuff like Crackhead Mick and Rev or Valentine, I love building and creating characters. But I was like, no, this is pushing it. I don't think I can do Jeffrey. And also, I'm thinking of me as a kid watching it going, I can't do this guy. And then they got back to me and said, they're going much younger in my American team. And so I auditioned sort of a bit like, let me just give this a go. It's not going to happen. And then when you start auditioning for something and then you go through the works of it, suddenly you fall in love with it, don't you? And it's like, I really, really want this. But I had a lot of sort of, between you and this other guy, but they were no's. And so I didn't hear anything for a couple of weeks and a good friend of mine had a recall with the directors and producers. So I was like, oh, well, I didn't get this.
For the
job.
Same role. Your friend was
same up for the role. Same role. Yeah, right. For the same role. You know, it's like, you all know each other. It's like,
yeah.
Up for it as well? Okay. Good luck.
Let's stay friends afterwards. Whoever gets it, we'll stay friends. Yeah, definitely.
Exactly. You have to have that sort of chat before, don't you? But when the call came, it caught me off guard because I was very busy auditioning for these other things. I'd just done Sorry, I Didn't Know, my comedy panel show on ITV. And when you get a conference call from your team, it's either we've got to work something out, you're close to something, you might have a job, or we need to strategize on some moves, you know? So I just didn't know. And when they told me, I literally cried, man. I literally burst out crying. It was amazing. And I remember my agent, she called it Joffrey. I was like, no, it's not Joffrey, it's Jeffrey.
It's not Game of Thrones.
Yeah, exactly. But, yeah.
No, go on, carry on.
No, sorry, I was saying, I was just tears of joy, you know, sadness as well, just because there's some people that I lost recently that are not around to see me play this role. But also a bit of relief because of so many close calls. And then actually I realized this is the job. This is amazing. Like, this is one of the jobs of the year. You know, getting a job's great, but an iconic show like this and to have Will and Quincy Jones behind it, it's amazing.
Has Will been down to set?
Not yet. He's filming Emancipation. We've been getting text messages via his PA saying, like, we all look amazing. And, you know, it's nice to know that he signed off on me as well. Do you know what I mean? You know, he's sort of, you've bought the job, but, you know, he sold the tapes. And I think we're going to be seeing him in a few weeks or something like that. And it's just a great vibe on set. I feel like his energy, as well as the creator, Morgan Cooper's energy, it's just amazing. They're just really beautiful, good people, big hearts. And yeah, everyone's having fun.
And did you ever find out? I mean, it might not interest you, but did you ever find out what they'd seen that put you on their radar in the first place? Do you ask that question? Do you want to sort of know? Was it like, what did you see me in that's put me in front of you?
You know what? Like, I think my team had been pushing hard for it. You know, like when they heard, I think it's a particular type of role where not everyone is not everyone's a natural fit. I think my team were like, no, this is definitely you. And I, when I spoke to the director, they were aware of my work. And I think in America, you know, especially with the stuff like In the Long Run was on Stars. I'd done Arrow as well. So you've got different forms. Actually, you've got me doing like drama with Arrow and doing indie movies out here. But then also you've got me doing sort of almost coming to the America-esque comedy with In the Long Run. And I think even though we're doing a drama, they wanted an actor that just had those nuances within them to be able to give us a bit of a flavor of the old Jeffrey, but at the same time, this is going to be a dramatic version. And so I feel like I was in with a great shot because of the work I'd already done. But at the same time, you just never know, do you? You just never know. But they did say after my first tape, they were like, yeah, we think that's the guy. And then when I did a recall, it was terrible. My recall, I couldn't see them. The Zoom wasn't working. That's why I was asking you when we started. Can you see me? So you know what it's like, Alec, acting 101, never look at yourself in the mirror. Imagine doing the biggest audition of your life and you can't see the person that you're reading with. So all I can see is myself. And I, you know, as an actor, I was like, well, I'm just going to have to give it a go.
That sounds like torture. Crazy. Like,
oh, crazy, right? I couldn't see him. And like the director's giving me notes. And so there is no, we've got eye contact right now. So I'm like, okay, are you just giving me notes? But in your head, you're going, well, I'm doing it bad because he's saying he's giving me all these notes. But if you see in their eyes, like, no, I like what you're doing. If they're not saying that, you can see he's like, I'm just trying to give you a different direction. So I felt like I jumped through some mad hoops to get it. But it's that weird thing, isn't it? When it's yours, it's yours. Mm. And
I mean, you say like, this is the show. Does it feel like the biggest or at least one of the biggest shows you've done?
Yes, it does. It does, Alex. It does. And what's great about it is that it's, it's a story that's being told by Morgan Cooper. It's his vision. You know, there's a sense of like Black excellence about it as well, you know, and in an inclusive way. It doesn't matter who you are, where you're from, what upbringing you've had. Everybody knows the show, but the way that we are telling this story with the people behind it and the way that they've just been able to nurture Morgan Cooper and allow him to impart his vision on the world, it's just beautiful. And I think you have to look at someone like Will Smith as well to sort of, obviously Will Smith's a name that can greenlight a lot, but he still has to make the decision to say, I'm going to back this guy. I'm going to back this guy, Morgan Cooper. And not only that, you know, I'm going to back this young guy, you know, Jabari Banks. And it starts from the top. And this feeling is across the whole of the production, the production team, the crew. And there's a sense of excitement and everybody's proud. But also, we've got to do the work, Alex, right? You can't just be bathing in the, oh, look, Will Smith behind it. Oh, it was a great show. There's still a sense of that we've got to turn up and do the work, and everybody's pointing in the same direction and working hard to make this the best show that it can be.
I'm excited. As I said at the start, it sounds like it sounds like a kind of out there idea, but but in a really interesting way. I would never have thought of it. Like the idea of taking a sitcom and retelling a similar story in the modern day, it sounds great. So that's what you're doing right now. But like, just to take you back to the very beginning, when did you first decide that you wanted to be an actor that set you on this path to now being in Los Angeles making this show?
Oh, that's a good question. It's a good question. I wanted to be a footballer first, you know, when I was young. I wanted to play professional football and, but drama. I went to a school called Cumberland School in East London, Canning Town, and I had an amazing drama teacher called Mr. Tyers. And he would always take me out of maths to help him in his drama classes, even the ones where, like, if I was in the first year, I'd be helping the fourth or the fifth years. And I think it was very easy to just be around people and just jump in and do what I need to do. But at no point, Alex, did I feel like I wanted to be an actor. And I had a moment where my family, a friend went to Silver Young's, and that's where all the young actors were going, and they were popping up on TV. And a couple of my friends did, and I was like, wow. One friend, he literally was at my school, left, went to Silver Young's, and he had a nice little bit on Only Fools and Horses. And I was like, wow. But I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to be an actor. I wanted to have a normal sort of upbringing and go to normal school. I didn't know much about stage school, but just from, you know, the vibes that I pick up, I was like, no, I don't want to do that. I just want to play football with my mates, get some chicken and chips afterwards on the Barking Road. You know what I mean? Go home and play, you know, play the Mega Drive. Not to give away my age.
a Mega Drive? What on earth is that?
Stop that. Stop that.
I know what a Mega Drive is. I know. We're the same age.
But seriously, I left secondary school with an A in drama, and then I went to Epping Forest College, and I still wanted to be an actor. And I just said, the woman wouldn't let me on the course at first. She was like, you've only got an A, you've got too many. All my C's turned into D's. I was having too much fun at school. And then I really stuck up for myself. I was like, look, I'm better than a BTEC first diploma. So let me do the BTEC national diploma, which is 2 years. If I was going to do the first, it would have been 3 years. I was like, I ain't got time for that. She said, okay, if you retake English, I retook it. A week later, I was given an assignment to do a monologue. It could be fact or fiction. And I wrote this monologue about going to the West End Trocadero with my brother and playing Street Fighter all night. Him and me had £5 each given by our eldest brother. We spent all that money on the Street Fighter, you know, trying to be the best players in the arcade. And then we stayed out all night and walked home, but we saw some orange juice and on the side by this bakery shop, and we picked it up, put it in our pockets, and then we got arrested because someone had been stealing stuff for like weeks and months, and they thought it was me, my brother, and a couple of our friends. So I did like a Eddie Murphy raw, you know, sort of stand-up monologue about that, where I play all the different characters. You know, I play my father come to get me at the police station. You know, I was dressed like a, you know, like a, thinking I was like this rude boy on the streets, you know, when I was like 16, 15. I had a soundtrack of Apache, UK Apache Indian, you know, the junglist tune. And it was amazing. And then at the end of it, Alex, I got a standing ovation. And the buzz, Alex, the buzz, it was like, oh my gosh, this is what I want to do. It was like an arrow just went bang. It was like, I want to be an actor. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to go to university. I want to go to drama school. I want to get an agent. I want to start working. It all happened in that one moment. I still tried to hold on to the football stuff, but the more that I fell in love with acting, I stopped playing semi-pro football, and the rest is history. I am. I've gone from the Barking Road to Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles.
That's amazing that it was just that one moment and that, you know.
It just hit me. And I think my drama school teacher saw it in me, you know, but I didn't see it. Do you know when some people see the things in you that you can't see? And now when I look back, I was like, well, it does sort of make sense. I love drama. I love sort of pretending to be people. But when I went to drama school, Academy of Live Recorded Arts, when I met, I was one of the youngest, 17, just turned into 18. But a lot of my peers, they knew they wanted to be actors from like 6 or 7, you know? They knew what, you know, what backstage meant, or funny joke. I mean, when I heard the term take out the blacks, I was like, what? What are you talking about? Was that from East London? You can't say, oh, that's the curtain thing. Because it's not my world, Alex. I'm not like, what? What's going on here?
How archaic is this disgusting industry? All right, sorry. Right, got you. Yeah.
Okay, cool. There's no chips here. There's no chips on the shoulder here. But I was just coming from I was just a normal working class East London guy that had gotten into drama school. I couldn't afford it. Luckily, I wrote to Newham, one of the poorest boroughs in the East, to say, look, I'm working as an usher at Theatre Royal Stratford East, so I'm paying for my rent in my little council flat. I just need the fees so I can go to the school. I'm probably one of two, if not the only one in East London right now, that's got into a drama school. Please help. And they did. And it was like the last sort of time when the government, they were doing those grants. And I was just coming from a place of, I was quite naive and green, but I loved pretending to be people. And then from drama school, you learn that it's a bit more than that. But that was where it started for me.
So it started when you got the standing ovation. Did you get some laughs as well? If it was a bit, was it like?
Lots of laughs. For me, comedy's been my way into acting. I love comedy. I'm not a stand-up comedian, but I grew up, you know, Eddie Murphy's, Steve Martin's and stuff like that. Gene Wilder. Richard Pryor. So laughter was always a validation for me that I'm doing something right. And so when I got that laughter doing that monologue, it did remind me of the beginning of, I think is it Delirious, when Eddie Murphy's wearing the red suit. But before that moment, he's a little kid. Samuel Jackson's part of the family's an uncle. And he tells a rude joke about, he's about eight. He says, I kicked the lion in the doo-doo or something like that. And all the family like, and Samuel Jackson's like, oh my God, that boy's got talent, you know? And then it cuts to Eddie. When I got that standing ovation, I felt like Eddie Murphy on stage, you know?
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And I suppose the applause, Alex, and the laughter for me, I realized that was me scoring a goal or making assists as a footballer. The pitch for me was being on stage, you know? And then the competitiveness of, got to win this game is me going, I've got to nail this part, or you know what I mean? I need to be the best that I can be as this character.
So you just readjusted, you know, the drive from one. That's interesting. I remember asking your co-star from Rev, Olivia Colman, like at the Empire Awards years ago. I said to her, I was like, so which do you prefer? Because I knew her as a comedy actress, but I think she just done the first thing I'd seen her in as a dramatic actress. And I said to her, what do you prefer, comedy or drama? And she said drama, like in a split second, drama. And I remember being so surprised by that, because for me, I've always considered comedy to be the more difficult skill potentially to learn. And I'm not saying I'm right. This was my view of it, that comedy is the more difficult skill to learn and potentially the most rewarded. Where would you put yourself on that scale? I guess the question is, like, I guess to simplify it, would you say it's easier to be a great dramatic actor who can then learn the skill to be a comedy actor? Or do you think comedy is something that is kind of not innate, but a much more difficult skill to learn? You could be a great dramatic actor and never potentially be able to nail comedy.
I think comedy is much harder to learn. Yeah. I think it's something you either have or you don't. And I think it's weird. I love doing comedy, but I think I'm the same with Olivia. I think it's drama. Yeah, I get told, Jimmy, you don't do enough comedy because, you know, you're great at it. And I think there's a sense of me that I like to keep people guessing. Do you know what I'm saying? I feel like there's a version where if I continue to do comedy, that's all I might end up doing, which could be great. But I think once you taste, if you've come from that space, I think what Olivia might be talking about is that once you do drama, it gives you such it's such a different feeling, you know, and you're able to stretch yourself in a complete different way. And it's so refreshing that it becomes more appealing. And at the same time, you know, you get more, I get more opportunities with the comedy, but there's something about being as real as an authentic as you can be. And you always have to have that with comedy, but to not have any instant feedback with laughter or any sort of get out clause of trying to make people laugh, just to be, as we're talking now as human beings, and just to be in that pocket, I think it's really sort of hard and tricky. And also I think it shakes things up for me. I feel like I want to lean into that. And play like real life people and stuff like that. So I think I'm the same. I might change my mind in 10 minutes.
So do you kind of internalize the sort of the reward system? Like, for example, I do want to talk about Kate and Koji, but for example, you're filming that in front of a live studio audience. So you are getting a laugh when something is funny, and that immediately goes, nailed it, big laugh, got that line. And there's a response from other people. If you are playing a dramatic role, do you then know internally, you go, fucking hell, I really, really nailed that performance, that moment in that scene? Are you still being able to?
No.
Sort of, you don't get that.
No, I don't think so. No. No, I don't. If you start thinking like that's when you're like, what happened to that actor, Jimmy? It doesn't work anymore because you're too aware. No, I feel like I have to, when I'm in the drama, I'm just in it. I can't really think about the outside response, you know? Mm. I might have a feeling afterwards we do the take, oh yeah, that felt good, but I don't know. But with studio live comedy, once you get that laughter, that's brilliant. But actually when you do single cam comedy, like something like Rev or Curb Your Enthusiasm, there's no immediate laughter. So again, you're having to straddle that line of being really real. Do you know what I mean? In the moment. But no, when I do drama, no. I mean, sometimes after I do a take, I might be like, yes, brilliant. We smacked that. You know what I mean? And then the director's like,
yeah, go again.
Do another one. Yeah. Like, oh,
the lighting wasn't right. You missed your mark. Something completely inconsequential to your performance, but you have to do it again. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Kate and Koji, like, first of all, what a massive hit. That was like, I think the first episode was like 6 million viewers, and then it was always above 4 million, which puts it in the bracket of some of the like the most watched sitcoms in the UK.
Yeah.
Which is a massive in itself. B massive because I think it's been about it was 7 years since ITV had done a studio based sitcom in the first place. Mm-hmm. First of all, what attracted you to become part of that project?
First of all, I would say it was the writers, Andy and Hamilton and Guy Jenkins. You know, through the work they'd done, Outnumbered, Drop Dead Donkey. I did Ballot Monkeys with them. Like, they are, you know, the goats of comedy. Do you know what I mean? Like, with comedy, there needs to be an element of trust. You know what I mean? And so I was excited to work with them, but also for me, also where my career was going, I wanted to show what I could do, do more sort of leading roles. Do you know what I mean? I was doing it in some ways with Valentine, but I was one of the main leads, but it was Idris's story. And then like stuff with like Rev or Big School, I was sort of coming in and coming out, do my little cameo bits, get some laughs and get out. And it was really nice to have my first sort of title lead in the UK, you know? And again, this was a job that I booked while I was in the UK, but I've been living in the US. So I'm always sort of conscious of like, okay, the pots, like where am I with the theater? You know, as 2016, I'd done the Royal Court, that was great. But in terms of like UK TV, I haven't really had a lead, you know? And so it was great to do that in terms of the comedy side of things. And then also I love the story because when I first sort of read the synopsis, I was like, ooh, is this, I'm not sure about this, but when I read the script, I was like, this is very clever. It has if you look at it just without a glance, you're like, ooh, it's got a bit of a 80s love thy neighbor vibe to it.
Right.
You know, just because you just look at what's going on here. We're not in those times anymore, but actually it's very clever because when you watch it, it's not that at all. It's much more sophisticated and it's really addressing a lot of the issues that are going on today. And actually there were some comments, people saying, oh, she's racist. She's not. She's just like a moany woman that's horrible to everybody. But because you're seeing her be a certain way with a person of color and where we are, they're like, oh, no, you can't do that. And it's like, no, listen to what's being said and listen to how my character is. He's a wealthy, you know, doctor from Africa that's also a bit snooty looking down on this sort of working class calf, you know? And so I just felt like it was a brave show to do and, you know, a little bit like risky. And I tried to do that with my work. And actually, once I heard Brenda was doing it, I'm a massive fan of Brenda Blethyn. I was I can't wait. I've got to do this.
It's weird, isn't it? I mean, I hope that it launches more studio-based sitcoms because, like I say, they're a rare beast in the UK. Yeah. Whereas, obviously, you look over where you are now in America and you've got, I mean, any number of, like, massive sitcoms from Cheers to Frasier to, Big Bang Theory, Two and a Half Men. Did you sort of look to any of those for, not inspiration, but were you sort of, I don't know what the word is, advice or guidance?
Alex, no, I did. I tell you what, you know, like I grew up watching a lot of those that you've mentioned, but for me, I thought about the iconic characters, you know, like people like Roger Lloyd Pack, Trigger, you know, those ones we like, oh, I love Trigger. And then another one was, is it Miles that plays Frasier's brother?
Niles,
Like they were two people that popped in my head in terms of impact and people that you were always excited to see when they were on screen. And when I thought about Koji, I was like, it'd be great if I could sort of have an essence of that this character that we're rooting for him, even though he can be a bit of a stuck up git at times, but like this thing where you really you're starting to notice his little tics and his little isms and so I did. I looked at, but because a lot of the classics, they worked for a reason. You know, and I like to sort of be quite surgical. Then let me take a bit of that, and then let me put that in this pot in terms of what I'm trying to create with my character. And I do that with a lot of my work. I sort of even like the character in Rev. You know, I thought about Samuel Jackson a lot. You know, in terms of when he was a gator in a Jungle White Fever. and, you know, and then his personal journey about being a, you know, working through his drugs and journey and stuff like that. And so, yeah, it's, I think it's life as well, isn't it? I try to pull on all the experiences and also the things I've seen growing up and the areas that I've grew up in around.
I mean, is there going to be a season two, just before I move on? Because I know there was talk of a season two, but I think, you know, it was supposed to start filming about now, really.
Yeah, there is.
That was me.
Yeah.
That was me looking at my clock, by the way. I've got a clock on the wall that tells me the dates. It's got a massive date on it. I was like, yeah, November the 8th. Yeah, about now.
No, there is going to be a season two. And I'm just, in terms of dates and stuff, I'm not sure. Obviously, everybody's busy. So it's about when that's going to happen.
Mm. And I know you said, you know, you're sort of aware of not doing too much comedy. I think you said in an interview I read where you said you like to balance, you know, you want to do drama and then you want to do comedy. Then you want to do drama when you do comedy. And you've done a lot of comedy recently, though, I think it's fair to say.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Popped up in the little show that could, the show that sort of everyone was like, all right, that turned into Apple TV's massive hit, Ted Lasso. You were there at the very start of that.
Yeah. It's so, as a friend sent it to me yesterday, going, an American friend, like, wow. Like, because a lot of people are coming to it late, you know, because Ted Lasso's just taking over everything. It's been a massive hit. But yeah, that was a great gig. I remember booking that here in the UK. And I've always been a fan of Jason Sudeikis. I mean, booking that in the US, I did. And I flew back for it. And again, here I am. I booked another comedy. So I was doing In the Long Run, Ted Lasso, and then Kate and Koji, like three comedies, you know, at the same time. But also, it's not that, oh, it's a comedy, I'm not going to go out for it. If it's good, then I want to do it. And also, I like to work with great people. You know, Jason Sudeikis is very funny. He improvises quite a lot. I love to impro as well. And so on set with him was a dream, because you've got the little bit that's written and then you're just playing. He says what he wants to say, I say what I want to say, and then they keep what they want to keep in the edit. And I think originally we were going to, Ollie, my character, was going to have more of a journey, but I think they were writing as they go along. And I had booked a drama, a Quibi drama called Most Dangerous Game with Liam Hemsworth and Christoph Waltz, which was drama, you know, drama thriller. So I was a bit like, well, I'm doing this, I've booked it. And they didn't really get to use me as much as they would have liked. And then I was like, I've got to go to Vancouver and shoot that. So again, it's nice to have had a little cameo in a great hit show. But at the same time, I think that's a perfect example of me going, yes, I want to do this comedy, but hey, I've got to go and do this drama as well. Let's keep people getting and let me keep flexing, you know, the muscles in both areas.
And when it, obviously, because like you say, it was right at the start that you were doing it. Did they feel like they had a hit on their hands, or was it a bit more like fingers crossed? Let's see what happens here.
You know what? Actually, it's a good question. It's a good question. I think it had a bit of a feeling like it could be a hit. Yeah. I think if I remember, there was rumors that a season two was going to happen before we'd stopped filming. You know, like,
oh, wow.
There was still a couple of months, and I think the execs were very happy, and I think what already they had in the editing room was looking great. And actually, it's weird, right? Because you never really want to start having those conversations and feeling like that, because it could be the kiss of death, right? Yeah. Something feels really good. I think this is going to be the one, and it's, But this show definitely, it killed it. I think it was the timing for that type of content as well, you know, off the back of where we all were in the world. I just think it was the perfect show, you know, cup of tea, some biscuits, lock down and watch Ted Lasso.
That's it. Yeah, there was a lot of that, but a good show. But yeah, but also, yeah, people were desperate for some content. But then Apple TV had loads of other content, and that one, you know, it broke through. So
It's true, Alex, actually.
Testament to that show. Now, you've mentioned this show a couple of times, so I feel fine to talk about being part of the Arrowverse. Let's talk about some drama. That must have been kind of fun, playing Baron Reiter.
Yeah. Oh,
he, a super-powered bad guy. I mean, that's Was that an itch that you wanted to scratch?
Yes, yes. You know what I mean? You've got comedy, you've got drama, and then you've got kind of superhero stuff.
Look at those guns. Look at those guns.
You know what, Alex? One of my best friends, he's much more of a sort of comic Marvel DC nerd than me. But
right,
he was the one that put me onto sort of Arrow. And I was like, I was a Smallville fan back in the day. I was like, yeah. And then he's like, no, you should check it out. I was like, nah, I don't think I'm going to like it. Started watching it. And then I just binged the whole sort of season up to the end of series three. And then it's so funny, just back to LA, I got here in 2015. In the 3 weeks, I tested three times, didn't get a job. Then I went back to do Ballot Monkeys with the creators of Kate and Koji.
Yeah.
So I'd only been in the US for like maybe 3 months. Straight after Ballot Monkeys, I landed straight back into LA. That night, I got an audition for Arrow. During the first 3 months, I auditioned for Damien Dark in season four. He was the main villain in Real Time. So I went in there, I wore like a green George Oswald Boateng suit because I was like, you know, I was like, I'm going to go in there. You know, I did it as a Brit, as an American. And it was like a computer game. I went from one round to another round. And I was like with the top producers, Mark Guggenheim. And I think Belanti was looking at my tapes. And I got out of this audition, saw a couple of my mates there. They're like, how did you go? I was like, I felt like I smacked out of the park. I was like, come on. Me and my friend were in the car. He's got a little convertible. I get the call. I'm like, hello? My manager's like, Jimmy, they loved you. They want to pin you. I was like, great, great. What does that mean? Pin. It's like a pencil. I was like, okay. For the main villain. And he's like, do you want to do it? I was like, yeah, of course I want to do Arrow, you know? Your manager's always thinking like big picture. If you do this, you can't do the movie. I was like, I want to do it. Anyway, I'm going to be the new villain in Arrow. And then I don't get it. And they go with, I can't remember the actor's name, but he's a big actor, blonde hair, like crystal blue eyes, done like loads of movies and stuff like that. And I was like, well, he's much more experienced and well-known, but I was like, damn, I was so close. And so fast forward back to coming back to the US after being away for a couple of months. So I landed, and that same night, I got an audition for Arrow for Baron Reiter. And apparently, you know, I put it out on Twitter, I'm back in LA, this is my fourth month. And then I think one of the casting directors was following me and they contacted my agent. I went in the next day, just learned it that night. And it was, again, a bit bumpy, you know, a bit bumpy in terms of like, I didn't feel like I was in a proper flow because I just landed. But I got the role. And originally, Alex, it was just guaranteed 3 episodes recurring. And again, the competitive guy in me is like, all right, if you're going to play me for just 3 games, you know what I mean, but not the final, well, I'm going to bang in a hat trick, so you make sure you keep using me. And after the first episode, the manager was like, Jimmy, they love what you did. They've booked you for another 5. And in the end, I had a whole arc and I did 15 of the 22 and became, you know, one of the main villains in the flashbacks. And that was my first gig. That was like my first sort of 4 months of being in LA, you know? And so that was amazing. And in year two, didn't go as well. the yin and yang, you know what I mean? I'm still working. But suddenly LA opens up and you're looking at all these other things and, you know, House and Cards auditions or, you know, Independence Day movie auditions and you don't get them and you're like, oh, okay. But then you don't have time to be too down because more things come all the time. But for me to be a part of the Arrow universe and also trying to make an impact, Alex, you know, I was like, I looked at all the different villains. I don't know, my favorite villain was Manu Bennett's character. What's his name? Blade, right? Is it Deathstroke? Oh, I can't forget his name. I forgot his name. But he was one of the best villains.
Yeah, Deathstroke, I believe. Deathstroke.
Yeah. Or Slade Wilson or whatever. Yeah, Deathstroke. So I was like, Deathstroke was brilliant. He killed Arrow's mom, like the samurai sword. I was like, oh, if I can do something like that. And then, Alex, they're giving me this, all these superpowers. I'm searching for this I was just like, oh, this is great. I killed a plane by doing that. I was like, come on. I'm picking up Stephen Amell and like throwing him across the set. I was like, this, I am living my dream.
Yeah, you get to say things like valiant effort, Mr. Queen, but still only mortal.
Come on, come on. I loved it. So it was a great, great job.
That's amazing, though. That's a really useful, that's two really useful points there, I guess, for anyone who is like, oh, I really want to, you know, book work and, you know, get more work, is A, be on social media and tell people which city you're in. Just by going, I'm back in LA. It's like, oh, he's in LA. Oh, let me call him. That's great.
Yeah.
And also, I love the idea that they've got you for three episodes on paper and then you go in, show them what you can do. And suddenly they're like, let's call it a round 15, shall we?
Yeah. No, thank you. Because there's another way going, oh, I've just got three. I'll speak to some actors. They just, and it's like, no, it doesn't have to be like that. Do your work and, you know, and do it well. And it can be much more. Like the girl that plays Felicity, she had a couple of episodes. She was playing the assistant, the geeky assistant. And then she was so good that they just kept writing her in. And then she became the love interest, right? Mm-hmm. The original love interest, her storyline just went a bit sideways and you went with her. But when you see how good she is and the rapport that they had on screen, you're like, it's a no-brainer. It's a complete no-brainer. So I don't know, the more of the story is do the work and do your best and leave it up to...
Yeah, and believe that the control is in your hands as well, I guess. The idea that on paper, it's like, oh, this is just what I've been done, but you actually still have the power to, you know, shift the parameters of what you're going to be doing. That's cool.
And also, Alex, when you don't get the jobs, trust when they, you know, I had feedback, we love Jimmy, and it's easy to dismiss it, but the fact that they called me back was because when I auditioned for Damien Dark, you know, the original lead, that they remembered me, you know what I mean? And it was about finding the right thing. That was the feedback. We, you know, we loved you, that didn't work, but we want to find something for you. But I think a lot of us actors go, oh, you're just saying that. You're just trying to ease the blow. But actually, you never know who's watching. Put your best foot forward, do your best thing, and you never know when it's going to come back round.
Yeah, and don't walk out of the room going, you don't want me? Well, screw you then.
Yeah,
see you later.
Or put that on social media.
That's cool, though. I mean, I on the outside looking in, I imagine I'd be quite nervous, like walking into an environment where you are like walking into a show where the cast have been there for a while. They've done a few years at this point, and you're new. And, you know, they may be welcoming. They might not be welcoming. They might be like, this is my trailer. I'll be in there. I'll come out for my scenes. You know, I'm not here to make friends. I'm here to do a job. So I just wonder, you know, whether they were welcoming to you or whether it's very much, you know, you walk in and you go, it doesn't matter, you know, what the atmosphere is like. I know I can do this when it comes to the crunch.
It's a bit of both, Alex. I think that there was definitely an element of... it matters. There's an expectation, like, you know, you got this role, you need to come in and knock out the park, even though like your scenes at the end of the day, the lights go in, you've got a big monologue, Jeremy talking and all this sort of heightened sort of Shakespearean language. But there is a sense, my first day, I was like, oh, I'm feeling the pressure. They're under, you know, they're rushing. And it's on me first, you know, because they do the number one last, Stephen. And I just felt like, okay, I've really got to like drill down and lean on, like, they don't really know the work I've done, like lean on the work I've done in theater, TV and film in the UK, across the world, and just do my thing. And I remember it really, that competitive edge came out again in terms of like, okay, you know, I'm going to show you guys. I'm going to show you Mr. McQueen, you know, like, this is who I am. And I remember that was when I really cemented the character. It's because of the situation of, are you prepared, Jimmy? You know, lay it down, show them what you can do. And also try not to let the pressure of, like, they're all looking at their watches. Because this was like, it was my opening scene. And I think, again, I think they saw that. They saw that. The producers saw that. the showrunner saw that. And I think that was the beginning of like, we're going to use this guy more and more and give him, you know, great scenes. And, but I do think in America, there is that sense of there's no time to really wobble. You hear stories about it, but you really do have to turn up and be on your best game.
So Arrow is drama. We've done a lot of comedy. We're talking about another drama, which is obviously on ITV Hub now, which is The Tower. So tell me what excited you about this script. Because you're no stranger, really, to a crime drama. I think that's fair to say. You've done some before. But apart from this wonderful, if grisly, premise of two people falling from a tower block and the mystery beginning to unfold about who they, why they fell. It's a great premise on paper. Mm-hmm. What excited you about getting involved in The Tower?
You know what excited me about this, Alex, is that when I read the script, it was almost like it was written immediately in the middle of 2020, in the middle of the pandemic. But actually, it's based off of post-mortem Kate London's novel, which was written a few years ago. And the reason why it felt like it had been written in the middle of the pandemic by Patrick Harbison, who wrote Homeland. Again, I'm a massive fan. I'm still watching Homeland now. I just think that's an amazing show. And I didn't actually know Patrick was British. But when I read this script that he had adapted from the novel, we're in a place where we're talking about microaggressions and unconscious bias. And within this lean script, all within the unsaid and the subtext, I could just see it all, you know, in terms of, it wasn't just about racism, you know, it was also about sexism, abuse of power, unconscious bias, community. What does community mean? You know, if there's a certain diverse community, but someone else comes in from another like country, you know, do you accept them? And why don't you accept them? What are you thinking? And within that, you've got George Floyd happening, right? You've got issues about the Metropolitan Police still happening. And this three-parter sort of deals with all these things without actually hitting the audience over the head with it. And it's got such a complex, it's so complex and it's so nuanced. And for me, that excites me. That changes a project being a normal, this is another drama. When people watch this, even it's so different. It feels like it's not an ITV drama. No, again, no disrespect to ITV in terms of what they put out, but it feels like almost like a HBO sort of, you know, cable type of a drama. And that's what excited me. And also the original character in the book, he's a sort of gruffly old white guy, and they changed it. You know, they auditioned everybody, but they picked me. And I said to the producers, like, thank you, but I'm really interested to this police officer's journey, because he would have been through the sort of the McPherson Report, Stephen Lawrence times. He would have grown up at a time where, you know, you've got SUS, stop and search, you know. And so what was it like for a young black officer to be a part of the Metropolitan Police for these last 15 to 20 years, you know, and how hard is it for him? Why did he join the police force? And again, that we don't have scenes that he goes into his backstory, but within what's going on in the story, those things do pop up. You can't not see Steve's reactions to certain things and certain conversations he had. And that's what excited me, because it just made it much more current and relevant to where we are today.
So that's interesting. So initially on the page of the script, he was written as a white guy.
In the novel.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Okay. But when you got the script for the series, it wasn't specific.
It wasn't specific. You know, it's one of those ones where, you know, we've been there before, where do you say it or do you not? It just didn't say his race, but it did say the race of Lizzie, who Tahira plays, and she was white in the book. So, I was like, okay, I knew that she was black, but he didn't say about Steve.
So do they, at that point, I mean, obviously it helps you with your backstory and understanding where your character, and like you say, everything you just said, everything he's been through, does that need to then make its way onto the page? And does there need to be, you know, rewriting done because you've been cast as this character?
Yeah, definitely, tweaks. And that's what I loved. I'd worked with Jim Loach before, and Patrick Harbison, we jumped on a call And we had those discussions because the show also talks about having the awkward discussions, right? The uncomfortable discussion. And I suppose in some ways they were leaning, they were ready to have it, but this was a part of it. Going, okay, guys, this is what we're doing, but how you've written it, it can't stay like this. This is different because of all these different things. If you're making this a black guy, it would be different because of X, Y, and Z. And they were very open to that. And so things were changed. Certain scenes were tweaked and certain scenes were added. And I think that's the right way. That's how it should be, right? Because otherwise, again, you're being lazy and it's not starting from the truthful place. You know, you can't just, all right, rub it out, just change the white to black and just leave it. But no,
yeah.
There's different nuances that need to be considered. And they did a lot, you know, not tons, but quite a bit did get changed off the back of our conversations to make the story even more complex and nuanced.
And that was collaborative with you.
Yeah. And I think that's how it should be and how it can be, you know, to make a better show for everyone. And it's really interesting things. I grew up in a time where, I don't know, they still happen now, like certain jokes, like banter gets said, and it's sort of like, that's quite offensive. But do I pull it up right now in the middle of the pub in front of people, or do I let it go, you know? And I think The Tower really addresses that. So some people can say certain things, you're like, yes, out of order. Does it mean that they're completely terrible people? I don't know. And I think this show is going to have a lot of people debating, going, who's right and wrong, or whose side are you on? Because nothing's ever black and white, you know? Even if you look at where we are in the world, are you a Brexit supporter? Are you Trump? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Are you Labour, Conservative? And then you start putting that into friendships and families, and you realise that sometimes, in some ways, we're losing the ability to converse and have different opinions and viewpoints and still exist.
It's very true. And I mean, these are really, really fascinating questions that it'll be interesting to see the show handle, because, you know, I think you're absolutely right. I think there's a danger now, potentially, of, like, you know, ignorance is one thing, intention is another. But I think if someone, you know, to educate someone and go, you see, now that's not okay, is a conversation. And, you know, rather than, you know, alienating them and potentially driving them further down the route of ignorance, because, you know, you haven't been able to, you know, go, let's just talk about why that's not cool, and instead gone, shut them out.
Yeah. But also, for me, it's a sense of, I think, when I look at the show, I think this is a step forward, how TV can be truly represent society. You know what I mean? And sometimes I still see certain shows going, where's that supposed to be? Oh, God, that doesn't, you know, it's like, you know, Notting Hill, the movie. It's like, I don't know what Notting Hill that is, you know?
Is that London?
Exactly. And I feel like this show had to sort of ask themselves those questions and really trying to be authentic, right? That's what we want, authenticity. That's what we're looking for. But also, I think there's another version of doing this show, and it just hitting people over the head with it. It's in everybody's faces, and it's a bit too much, but this script doesn't do that. So I hope you enjoy it.
Excellent stuff. So that's on ITV Hub, available now, all three episodes of The Tower. You've been very gracious with your time, Jimmy. I'm sure you've got a busy day in Los Angeles. Congratulations, man. It looks like things are just flying at the moment, and well-deserved. I can't wait to see Bel Air. And thank you for your time, man. It's been an absolute pleasure.
No, thank you. Thank you for the work that you're doing. You know, I do tune in and listen to your stuff quite a bit, and it's great to eventually be on here, you know, and have a lovely week. And I'm sorry that you're not getting any sun, but you know where I am.
Yeah, so come on. Yeah.
Hit me up.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns. Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello, Alex Zane here. Thank you for choosing to listen to Just the Facts. And while you can still enjoy these episodes forever, you might want to check out our brand new show, A Trip to the Movies, where each week a different famous film fan curates their perfect night out at the cinema, picking what snacks they'd eat, where they'd sit, who they'd go with, and of course, what movies they'd screen. If you love cinema as much as we do, search A Trip to the Movies with Alex Zane or head to our socials at Trip to Movies Pod. That's at Trip to Movies Pod to find out more.